Welcome to this RCGP podcast on cervical and endometrial cancer. I'm Dr. Tony Hazel, GP and Deputy Medical Director for e-learning at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Dr. Anne Connolly, a GP in Bradford with a long-standing interest in women's health. Anne has been a colposcopist and a hysteroscopist and is currently chair of the Primary Care Women's Health Forum and RCGP Clinical Champion for Women's Health. Thank you for joining us today, Anne.
Hi, great to be here. Thanks so much for asking me to talk about these important subjects.
So I should start with a bit of educational background. This podcast is part of the RCGP Women's Health Hub, in which we bring together e-learning on a variety of topics. We already have courses on ovarian cancer and vulval cancer. So this podcast and the accompanying e-learning module is aiming to fill the gap by providing some education on cervical and endometrial cancer. In the podcast, we're particularly going to focus on prevention, so perhaps we should start by talking about the risk factors for these two cancers.
Great point. And the thing about these two cancers is they do have different risk factors, so we've got to think about them very differently. So firstly, cervical cancer is largely driven by infection with human papillomavirus. 99.7% of cervical cancers are caused by HPV. There are a few other smaller risk factors, smoking being one, small links to combined oral contraceptive use, early sexual debut, and high parity being the others. But the majority is due to several high-risk strains, oncogenic strains of human papillomavirus. Whereas for endometrial cancer, the majority of women with risk factors, it's due to their excess oestrogen. So, for instance, we know if a woman has a uterus or an endometrium, she has to take a combined HRT because you can't give unopposed oestrogen because that is a risk factor for the endometrium. And we know that one. But there are other important risk factors. Obesity is such a significant one. And we know endometrial cancer rates are going up because of the obesity epidemic. Oestrogen is made in adipose tissue, basically. So that is an endometrial risk. And there are some other risk factors such as diabetes, polycystic ovary syndrome, where women are having long time between periods and they have anovulation. That gives unopposed oestrogen for the endometrium. And tamoxifen is fantastic for the breasts, but not great for the endometrium either. So they are sort of the risk group that we can think about for endometrial cancer. And when we think about who do we need to investigate, and who don't we?
So let's start with cervical cancer and talk a bit about HPV. Now, you and I are both far too mature to have been offered the HPV vaccine, but the current teenagers are getting it in early senior school. And what does that do to the risk of getting cervical cancer?
Our HPV vaccine is absolutely stunning and is transforming the risks for women getting cervical cancer. At the moment, obviously, we've got to still do the screening program. But there may be a day when, in the very far future, when that's completely unnecessary. It is so good. There's a BMJ paper that clearly demonstrates the reduction in risk of both cervical cancer and the precancerous changes, CIN1, 2, and 3. And it showed a risk reduction of 97% for CIN3 and 34% for invasive cancer in women who had been vaccinated. So, you know, that's by their early 20s. And that's compared to the unvaccinated population that we know. And we've got good data coming out of Scotland where they were followed up earlier. So it's really excellent. So there is a current concern about reduced uptake of the vaccination. Partly that's due to the pandemic and there needed to be a school catch-up program for those kids who missed it in year 8. But also there's vaccine hesitancy at the moment, and we've all got a real role to try and encourage boys and girls and their parents to let them have HP vaccination because it is so good. Now, the vaccine was originally a quadrivalent vaccine, or at least the one we've been using up until just now. So that had two high-risk strains of HPV, 16 and 18, which are the ones that are most associated with the development of cervical cancer. And then it also included the strains 6 and 11, which are associated with genital warts. And again, we've seen a massive reduction in genital warts in the vaccinated cohort. Recently, and over the last couple of years, it's changed the use of a non-avalent vaccine, which has got five other high-risk oncogenic HPV strains in it. So it further improves the efficacy at reducing cervical cancer. The vaccine, if youngsters have missed it in school, we can give it in the GP practice up to the 25th birthday. So that's for girls who are born after September the 1st, 1991. And because it was given later to boys, boys who are born after September the 1st, 2006, can also get the vaccination given by us in general practice.
That's a great summary. Thank you very much. So I guess we can be looking out in general practice for kids who might have missed their vaccine in school. So our knowledge of the relationship between HPV and cervical cancer has significantly changed the cervical smear programme. Can you just outline how it works now?
So, yes, there's been a huge change over the last few years since the recognition that HPV is so important. So the samples, which are still taken the same way, like a traditional smear test, they go through an automated system and the machine decides if they've got HPV infection or not. If the sample is negative for HPV infection, then the sample is discarded. And then you go back to getting your routine recall as would be appropriate for your country. So it's slightly different. In England, it's 3 years between the age of 25 and 50. After 50 to 65, it's 5 years. In Wales and Scotland, they've changed to a five-year recall between 25 and 65. In Northern Ireland, they're currently still doing cytology first. So it goes through the previous way that we used to have across the rest of the UK. So cytological examination and then tested for HPV if you have low-grade dyskaryosis, so low-grade changes. If you have low-grade dyskaryosis and HPV negative, then you are put back on the normal screening recall for Northern Ireland. If you have low-grade dyskaryosis and HPV positive, then you go to colposcopy. If there are high-grade dyskaryotic changes, then you go straight to colposcopy. So that is the slight disparity at the moment. Now, in England, Scotland and Wales with HPV triage, if the test is positive, then cytology happens. So it goes back through the process, but it's probably only about 10-15% that has to do that now. So it makes it more accurate, as cytology is very difficult to do, especially at the speed they were having to do it. So it simplifies the program. It also makes it more sensitive and specific. If the test is positive and cytology shows no cell changes, then you have to have another smear in a year, and it goes through that same process. But if it's HPV positive with cell changes, then you head for colposcopy. Now, many women still don't come for their smears because of a number of reasons: embarrassment, they're late, they panic, they think we're going to tell them off, they are busy, they're worried that they'll find something, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And there's embarrassment, and there are certain other traumatic issues, particularly those who've had sexual trauma or female genital mutilation, or some other trauma. So we're looking at doing self-testing swabs, just like we have moved on to with chlamydia, which is much more acceptable for many women. But they can't switch to that until they're sure it's as accurate as the current smear process. And at the moment, there's a little bit of concern that it's not quite as reliable as picking up those higher grade CIN2, CIN3 changes. So there's projects happening to look at this, and it's going to transform it for us as a workforce, but also for women. But we've got to be sure it's accurate first.
Thank you. That's great. And it's quite exciting that things might change so much with a move to self-swabs, you know, potentially within my career. Can you just remind us, when should women start and stop having smears? And are there any groups who need them more often than usual?
Yeah, great question. So I've sort of covered it, but smears are offered from 25 to 64 in all countries in the UK. And women will get their first invite from about 24 and 6 months. We stop at 65 unless one of the last smear tests was abnormal, in which case she will be put on a specific recall for whatever that finding was. So women with HIV are different. They need a colposcopy at diagnosis, which is usually arranged by the consultant who is managing their HIV infection. And then they will require annual smears until the age of 64. They're more at higher risk of the oncogenic forms of HPV and of cervical cancer, so they need closer monitoring. Now, there's been an ongoing debate about doing smears under the age of 25, and they were traditionally done by that years ago. But many women will get HPV infection and then deal with it themselves. So there was a worry, or there were found, that some women were being found to have early changes concerning to colposcopists and to women, and then they were given treatment, which they probably wouldn't have needed until they, because they sorted out their own HPV infection. And so there was sort of over-treatment, and a LETS procedure, particularly if it's more than one, is associated with premature labour. So the campaign was shifted, so now the programme starts at 25, and I fully endorse that. There are other people who will give us challenges in primary care because of our systems. So trans men, if they have changed their gender marker on the notes, they'll fall out of the smear recall system. But if they have a cervix, they will still need a smear. Now, the RCGP is campaigning for notes to have a sex and gender marker so the patients can still get recalled. But at the moment, we've got to make sure we've got our own systems in place so that we can make sure that anyone who has a cervix still gets a smear. And it then a debate with your local laboratory system about how they manage that smear, because it will still be marked as a male. For men, this can often trigger worsening of their gender dysphoria. So, you know, this is someone who, if you've got someone in your practice who is much more experienced, they can do that smear and have enough time to go through it. Other patients who we need to be very careful with, I mean, obviously we need to be very careful with all our women, but those who have had sexual trauma in the past or who have undergone female genital mutilation, FGM, may need more time. They may need to come for a discussion and then choose not to have it done on that day and then come back at a different time. But, you know, we have to be very wary of women's needs on an individual basis, as we always do. The cervical cancer charity Joe's Trust has many resources that are really useful to optimise your smear taking process. So if you've never looked at it, please do. It's fantastic. And then finally, it's important that women understand that a smear is a screening test for asymptomatic women, and they must report abnormal bleeding at any age. So if someone under the age of 25 rings and pushes hard for a smear, ask them why. They may be having abnormal bleeding and actually need a face-to-face GP appointment. Any abnormal bleeding, such as intermenstrual, can be a sign of cervical cancer, but postcoital bleeding is the particular red flag. An examination of the cervix must be done in somebody complaining of postcoital bleeding or any other suspicious circumstances. But don't forget, chlamydia infection is much more common as a cause of postcoital bleeding in women under the age of 25. So please consider doing chlamydia and gonorrhea tests, because once you've treated that, often the symptoms will settle down, but have a low threshold for looking at the cervix.
That's great. Thank you. And I do think that's a really important point. I think the public are not necessarily great at understanding the difference between screening tests and tests that you do for symptoms. So let's move on to endometrial cancer. When should we particularly worry about that?
Yeah, another great question. You know, certainly endometrial cancer rates increase as we get older, whereas cervical cancer is more a problem of younger women. But lots of women sort of perimenopausally will get abnormal bleeding, and it is hard, isn't it, working out who should be investigated and who shouldn't. But we've got to have a low threshold, particularly for those who have those risk factors that we've discussed before. So intermenstrual bleeding is a abnormal bleeding pattern, and when you're taking a history, make sure you understand what the bleeding is that they're talking about. Get a good history, go over it a few times so you're absolutely clear. So intermenstrual bleeding, bleeding between the periods, particularly in women who are deemed to be older, and that's aged over 45, which was the initial recommendation by NICE. But we've got to be doing that holistic picture like we always do, and consider younger women also with risk factors, especially obesity, and particularly obeser women with oligo or amenorrhea, with also PCOS, because that anovulatory longer cycles is a risk factor for thickening endometrium with no protection from our natural progesterone. So you think about investigating those women, and in women who have got also persistent intermenstrual bleeding that you can't find another reason for it, as in they're not in hormones, you've done your chlamydia tests, etc., it's actually better to send them for hysteroscopy rather than ultrasound scan. Now, at the moment, there is quite a long wait for hysteroscopy and also actually ultrasound scan. But if you've got somebody who is higher risk, hysteroscopy is much better because it gives direct visualization of the endometrium and allows biopsies at the same time. Ultrasound scanning, it really depends where you are in the month as to what you expect the endometrial appearances to be. So it's much more complex about understanding the reports from ultrasound scanning, but it's easier to access, and actually it's more acceptable for some women. So, you know, high risk women think directly for hysteroscopy, lower risk women maybe ultrasound, but just be wary of the problems with ultrasound scanning and how you interpret some of those endometrial thickness results. And of course, for both cancers, we've got to be aware of the 2-week wait referral criteria, and you'll have that specified on your own for urgent referral forms. For cervical cancer, it's the appearance of the cervix that is consistent with cancer. So abnormal appearances, low threshold for referring to colposcopy. Endometrial cancer, the big red flag is postmenopausal bleeding over the age of 55. So that's bleeding more than 1 year after your last period, if not taking hormones. And we should consider a 2-week wait for postmenopausal bleeding if a woman's had an earlier menopause or under the age of 55. Other risk factors for endometrium or other women to look out for, suspected cancer guidance also tells to look out for women over the age of 55 with unexplained new discharge, those who have raised platelets or hematuria, or those who have hematuria or also have anemia or raised platelets or a high blood sugar. So, you know, it's written in the NICE guidance there on cancer, but just be clear about who you need to be thinking about. And of course, there is a box on the 2-week wait form to tick if the symptoms don't quite fit, but you've got concerns. You know, we do get gut feeling, don't we, in primary care? And sometimes you just think, I'm really not happy and I can't tick all these boxes. But, you know, just know that believe in your gut feeling at times. Obviously, we don't want to overfill the fast track forms, but an experienced GP, we get a feeling, don't we?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to end on. I know the chair of NICE once said that they write guidelines, not tram lines. And I think listening to that twitching antennae or that spidey sense is really really important. Mine's got me out of trouble on more than one occasion. And I think that's a useful point also to just signpost to our new cancer detection module, which talks about some of these soft signs like raised platelets and talks a little bit more about referral on the 2-week wait pathway and positive predictive values and things like that. So I think that's all we've got time for today. And I'd like to say a big thank you to Dr. Anne Connolly for joining us to discuss cervical and endometrial cancer. Thank you very much for listening. And if you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please have a look at the e-learning website or wherever you normally get your podcasts to find others on a variety of subjects. Thank you and goodbye.